This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. Now and again, you may hear bemoaning of how partisan politics have become, and inevitably, there is a call for more bipartisanship. But if politics is by nature ultimately partisan, what exactly does bipartisanship mean? This hour, Congressman Charles Rangel offers his interpretation. The new chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee spoke recently to the National Press Club in favor of representatives from the two parties working together on budget issues. But as the veteran New York Democratic congressman made clear, bipartisanship does not mean not criticizing the actions of the president of the other party. And we'll hear all of that today on Word for Word. Congressman Charles Rangel represents New York's 15th district. It's better known as Upper Manhattan, including Harlem, and parts of Queens. He's been the Democratic congressman there for more than 35 years. Rangel's Ways and Means Committee has jurisdiction over taxes as well as Social Security and Medicare, and it's one of the key centers of power in Washington. Charles Rangel has been a critic of the war in Iraq. In fact, he's called it a fraud. Rangel was in the news this winter introducing a bill that would have reinstated the military draft, though he acknowledges there's little chance of passage. And a veteran of Congress who can count heads, he sees little likelihood of stronger gun laws in the wake of the Virginia Tech massacre. He touched on that subject in his appearance at the press club the day after the shootings. Here then, New York Congressman Charles Rangel, speaking April 17th at the National Press Club in Washington.
For a lot of you who don't know me or of me, I want you to know that I've told most of the people in my family and friends that if and when I become chairman of the awesome and powerful Ways and Means Committee, that I didn't want to be treated any differently than any other world leader. And I've tried. We were talking up here about my longevity, and I tell people that when George Washington first asked me to run, that I had declined. But one of the most beautiful experiences I've had in working here were the friends that I've been able to make on both sides of the aisle. If I can think of any one legislator that allowed me to appreciate the system, the institution, the value of lawmaking, it was Tip O'Neill. And since that time, the House has become such a hostile environment to work under. I remember once when Clay Shaw from Florida was in the hospital, and he came back, and I had sent him some flowers or something. And he came over to sit on my side of the aisle, on the Democratic side of the aisle, and we talked mainly about our family and some other things, trips we had made together. And as soon as he got up to go to the other side, a young Democrat, who I did not even know his name at that time, said, "Now, what was that all about?" And so those kind of tensions even built as we found the Republicans trying to make certain that it was not the party and its philosophy that was demonized, but it was the members who happened to be Democrats. And needless to say, in politics as in human life, those people, young Democrats who were challenged, retaliated. And you had a situation where there was a degree of hostility, not only on the floor, but in the committees. And this was really exaggerated when you saw the few days that were spent in Washington, D.C., as young lawmakers had to decide whether they were going to spend time in Washington or more time back home. And the inflation of the price of homes meant that we never really got a chance to know each other. There was no real need to talk with each other. The whole idea of having hearings and discussions and amendments and debates was unnecessary because the law was made before it came to the floor. And we lost a lot of good moderate Republicans, especially in my state, as they were forced to bend to the will of the leadership in the Republican Party in order to make what they called a permanent Republican majority. And so there was a time that I was thinking about not serving out this term if we didn't get the majority, not because I wanted to have the power of the chairman, but because I couldn't tolerate the whole idea that going to work meant which fight were you going to participate in and not which bill were you going to try to get passed. But when we did win, then I realized that I could not afford to be a part of what I've been complaining about, and that is the partisanship. And so I had a friend in the White House, Hank Paulson, and I knew that he was leaving in 2 years. And I also knew that he did not have any interest in the food fights that we were having here. And I knew that he had the jurisdiction and executive branch that I would enjoy in the Ways and Means Committee. And I told him that there was a time that the Ways and Means Committee not only had a camaraderie, but because of the complexity of the legislation that came to our committee, that partisanship had nothing and no solution to any problem that we faced. And then as now, I cannot conceive of having a trade bill that would be partisan, or thinking that there was a Democratic or Republican way to solve the tax complexities that we have or the Social Security problems. And that I had hoped that if I could establish a relationship with the Republican majority, that we could at least see from the White House point of view, as long as I didn't have to deal with Cheney and the president, whether he would provide the liaison to show what we could do and not what we would be fighting about. And without suggesting to the president as to what language should be used in his proposal, that perhaps if it was screened through a guy like the Secretary of Treasury, it could not have the bite of partisanship that would have the Republican, that have the Democratic majority to just dismiss it as another political tool that they would be using. I then walked over to McCrary's office, and like I said, people were asking, do you think you can really work with McCrary? I didn't even know who the hell McCrary was. I mean, I knew the name, and the only time I ever heard from him is when I took a shot or two at Thomas, and he would, you know, defend him, but I hardly listened to his response. But I walked over to tell him that I had this discussion with the White House and wondered whether he could see his way clear to talk about it, because the Republicans had nowhere to go. They had no coattails for the next election. And we Democrats had not proven or had the opportunity to prove that we earned the right to be in a majority. And further, as I said earlier, some of the problems that we faced as a nation and the Congress would not be able to be accomplished in a partisan way. Social Security, tax reform, the AMT. And so I really think that that was the beginning of one of the nicest friendships that I've enjoyed in the Congress. And we go to meetings together. As a matter of fact, I invited him to come here, since this is the prestigious Newsmakers. I thought, since my dull speech wouldn't make news, if I showed up with the Republican minority member, that would make news. So I told him that, and he said that I should feel free to tell you that he would have enjoyed being with me this afternoon. But since he heard that on some TV show called Power Lunch that I had been kind to him, that he was going to be on that saying nice things about me, and I should share that with you. We've had, we've only had 3 bills that left the Congress, small bills, but we got applause from the House and visitors from the Senate, because in the first time in a decade, we've had the chairman and the ranking member on the same pieces of legislation. What did we talk about? We wanted to find out whether there was anything that was so complex that if people did not have a political problem with it, that we couldn't resolve. And out of all of the things within the jurisdiction of our committee, the Medicare fiscal condition was the only thing that we said to leave that alone if we want to get anything done until we can do something with the deficit. In the areas of the, say, the alternative minimum tax, that is the easiest thing to fix. The only thing is, where do you get the money to fix it? This is a tax that there is no legislative, political, or national justification why some people were pushed into a bracket that they were unintended to be in because of our failure to index the AMT for inflation. And each year that we don't do anything about it, kicking the can down the road makes the problem even more difficult. 23 million people suffer the burden of the AMT. About 7 million people in the middle class under that do not enjoy the benefits of the Bush tax cuts. If we were to try to do simplification and squeeze out all of the deductions and all of the credits that are no longer necessary or not too popular, we would be able not only deal with simplification, but to go after the $340, $345 billion that the IRS says is in the income tax gap. After we do that, it is my opinion that we can then take the rates within the system that's left and readjust them and perhaps give an assistance to the poor that through an expanded EITC, earn income tax credit, certainly adjust to make certain the burden of the middle class and the AMT people is removed, and we would then have a $1 trillion tax cut, which is what the AMT would be picking up in the extended taxes over the next 10 years. People would say, well, where would you get the $1 trillion? You get the $1 trillion from the tax code by making adjustment in the brackets. So far, McCrary has gone just far enough to say, where do you get the money? And he is working on a flat tax type of thing, which, of course, would generate a lot of money, but would have to eliminate either the income tax system or the Social Security system. It would be very costly in terms of what a flat tax might do. In any event, in order to make certain that Jim and I don't have a problem, our staff works together, not just on things that we want to do in common, but they fiercely compete with each other, knowing that if it's not a healthy competition, some staff member is in trouble. That means on almost every issue that we've had, we know what the problems are, and rather than talk, discuss, and argue about it, we start immediately seeing how we can resolve it. With the trade, and the Republicans actually wanted to establish a trade policy. That is, that maybe Democrats and Republicans can argue about some small items in the trade bill, but things that we were interested in, the United States trade representatives would not even discuss with us. Oh, yes, they would listen. But at the end of the day, when the trade bill was presented for an up and down vote, none of the recommendations that we made was there because Thomas did not want Democratic input. And as a result, many Republicans, not only in this but another issue, moderate Republicans, who were willing to see things in our way, not a Democratic way, but they thinking it was the right way, were forced to abandon that type of independence and to vote the Democratic line. It happened in health care, it happened in trade, and it happened in a lot of other areas, so that you can see that many moderate Republicans, because they bent to the delay rule that it had to be a Republican majority, were defeated. Three of my very good friends in New York State, not good enough that I didn't support the Democrat, but some pretty nice guys that I've known over the years. And so, as most of you know, the Constitution provides that the issue of trade, interstate trade, and commerce is reserved to the Congress. But because you can't have 535 negotiators dealing with trade, we give the lawyers power of attorney to the president. But we reserve the power of the Congress when we do that. So naturally, what we did is take all of the things that were rejected by the USTR when there was a Republican majority and to include those things that had been rejected. And those things, like I said, are child labor, slave labor, the ability of people that have life-threatening diseases to allow our pharmaceuticals to break the intellectual property laws for the purpose of helping them, other health provisions. And the major ones, which caused the most controversy, is establishing some basic labor rights for the workers, hoping that we can provide a way for them to become middle class and to be able to buy our exports and to be able to say that we did not allow people of wealth just to misuse the peasants' rights. In all of the CAFTA provisions that we asked this to come in, the foreign ministers and the leaders of these countries and the peasants in these countries and the religious leaders in this country wanted them included. Of course, they were excluded. And after negotiation with the administration, we got them to include in all of the objectives that Democrats wanted to get in. They agreed to allow this to be folded not only into this, but to be in the basis of the president's fast-track authority. Recently, or just after the Democrats had agreed to it, Republicans had agreed to it, and certain people in the White House agreed to it, the theory came up that there are provisions in the International Labor Organization rules that are not in our labor standards, and that Grassley had some theory that U.S. unions would go to the developing countries and agitate them to sue us, and then the World Trade Organization would establish our labor law, not policy law, which is pretty creative, except that some Republicans said that instead of U.S. labor doing it, that it would be Chavez, Hugo Chavez, would fund them to do these things. And at the end of the day, they would be able to say that they were creating our labor laws. Well, it doesn't make any sense, but that's what is holding up. Oh, no. They would then want a provision in the tax bill that would isolate the United States government from any liability for violations on our part. So you can see why that's a stickler, but we're still working on it and hope we can find the language that Democrats and Republicans can agree on. And so we don't know where we're going with these major things, but we do hope that's McCreary and I, who have incidentally have been given a fair degree of independence. I say that because we haven't had any problem with our leadership, but we don't have any reason to believe that if we are able, through our leadership on the committee, to bring our committee members together, which has been absolutely remarkable, that it would put our leaders in a position that they would realize that what we are doing would be good for the Congress and would be good for the country. And so we are having an exciting time in doing this. We don't know how much we have in our savings accounts of comedy, but we're prepared to use it if we think that we can win. And he asked me to share with you watching what we're trying to do, and hopefully where it's possible to be able to give us some support, because we truly believe that that's what our country really wants, to see us working together for the best interests of the people of our great country. Thank you so much.
Democratic Congressman Charles Rangel, who represents Upper Manhattan and part of Queens. He is chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, the first African-American to hold that post. Congressman Rangel spoke April 17th at the National Press Club. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After the speech, Congressman Rangel took questions from the audience, as read by the Press Club president, Jerry Zaremski.
First of all, a bunch of questions about bipartisanship. First of all, how did the spirit of bipartisanship break down in the House over the last two decades, and what lessons can you learn from that as you're trying to change the tenor?
I don't know what lessons you can learn, but there's no question that Newt Gingrich felt that not only should the 40 years of Democratic leadership be shattered, but that it be converted into a permanent Republican-type majority. And that's when I referred to the fact that the monies that was put into negative campaigning when they took office caused Democrats to use the same sword. And it's like in anything in your life, that if you really believe that someone doesn't like you, if you just believe it and you demonstrate it, you can bet your life they won't like you. And this just builds up. And someone says something unpleasant, and then it hits the floor, and it's generated into elections. And I think that the large amount of money that have been raised by all the presidential candidates and the length of time that they have to campaign is going to be such a temptation for negative TV campaigning to take place. And it's a strong candidate that takes negative campaigning, knowing how effective it is, that doesn't retaliate. And that has been our problem.
You talk about bipartisanship in terms of the leadership of the established parties. What do you think of the attempt to start a major effort to launch a third-party presidential candidate?
Forget about it.
Forget about it?
When did I say anything about bipartisanship between the leaders of the party?
No, you said between the establishment parties. I didn't say the leadership between the two parties.
I thought you did.
Did I?
The only thing that I was talking about was the Ways and Means Committee.
Do you see any signs beyond the Ways and Means Committee of this bipartisan spirit continuing elsewhere in the House?
That's very difficult because I think the Republicans and Democrats believe that the war is actually consuming the oxygen between the people and the president, and therefore the Congress and the president. And there doesn't seem to be any room for compromise as it relates to the bill that the war supplemental bill. I wish that there was, but I think there's a degree of polarization there that would restrict it.
Okay. A lot of questions about Ways and Means Committee business. First of all, what are the top three things you would want to change about the tax code?
I have said, even though we haven't created a track that I can ride on, that I really think that poverty and lack of education is the biggest threat that we have to our national security. That's maybe long range, but right now I think the AMT is the thing that we will be focusing on as our main objective to remove that permanently.
Mm-hmm. Republicans have taken a firm position that they won't accept any tax increase to fund AMT repeal. Given that stance, is there any real hope you can find Republicans that will be able to embrace your AMT approach?
Well, I said that it would be paid for within the code, and it would be revenue neutral.
Might that be portrayed as a tax increase, though, if you had to raise the rates?
Well, the way I look at it, Jerry, is that 23 million people have the AMT. 7 million would not have received the benefit of the Bush tax cut. That's 30 million taxpayers that would receive a $1 trillion tax cut. I guess you're right when you get to the upper bracket.
Would you support the push by the nation's freight railroads to get a tax credit for money they spend expanding their infrastructure?
Everything on every issue has to be on the table. Not only the benefits, the tax benefits that people receive now, as I said earlier, but certainly it would be in competition with people who are expecting tax breaks or tax incentives. We certainly know one of the things I didn't mention as relates to alternative energy sources, that we will be raising money for the purposes of giving incentives to alternatives.
There's been a great deal of attention lately on the tax treatment of hedge funds and private equity companies, especially that with regards to how fund managers are compensated. Are you planning to address this in any legislation?
We plan to address all of those things, which will include local and state taxes, mortgage interest deduction, and charitable contributions. What we intend to do about it is something else.
How long will it take to get fundamental tax reform, and will the tax system end up being flatter as a result?
Well, as I pointed out, there's no question that my Republican counterpart would like to see something done. What I didn't mention is that we're taking on the major tax issue, whether it's trade or taxes or health care, the ones that we think that we can best resolve in a bipartisan way. So as of now, all of our subcommittees are working in a bipartisan way to report to us as to where they think they have some degree of unanimity.
What does your committee plan to do about the continuing reduction of tax revenues from corporations while the American wage earner's share of tax revenues continues to go up?
Review it.
And then?
We don't know. Let me make it clear that Jim and I are going to do not what is the most important thing, but what we can do together. And what we cannot do, we're prepared to bite the bullet to make it more easy for the next Congress to deal with the very, very difficult things. And we have the cooperation of Hank Paulson to do it. And so even if the committee can't get around to it, we don't have to be stuck with what we have dealt with before. We can come up with plans that we may not have the money to resolve, but certainly that could be accepted as a roadmap for the next Congress. What we're going to do first would all depend on what degree of unanimity we can get on the issues.
Is there any hope for the renewal of fast-track negotiating authority this year?
Yes. First of all, as relates to Doha, that claims that they got new life and that they need fast-tracked in order to continue, we are prepared to give a restricted fast-track, limited to the Doha Convention. But everything that I said about having a foreign policy, a trade policy rather, that's bipartisan, that would necessarily be a part of any fast-track agreement that we would have with the executive.
How important is policy toward workers who have lost their jobs due to trade in the debate over renewing trade promotion authority? And what are the specific changes you would want to see in trade adjustment assistance?
I meant to say that that is also a part of what we hope to be a bipartisan trade policy. That is, trade and Lou Dobbs and anyone who's lost a job, trade has got to take a hit for it. We recognize that if we don't move forward in trade and be competitive, that we'll be moving far behind. So it's not only necessary that, in my opinion, that we give our U.S. firms a fair advantage in competition, but they have to help us to remove the stigma that our business just don't care who was hurt And so included in our document is that the U.S. Trade Representative should take in consideration what U.S. industries are going to be impacted, what globalization would do in terms of affecting communities, even if it's not related to trade, and how, as our multinationals can go in developing countries and train the people to be productive, how they can take a look at our cities and counties that are economically depressed and be of assistance to them. And lastly, to get back to the question of education and poverty and national security, to play some role as a partner with the United States so that we don't have to depend on importing people that have knowledge of technology, but to make certain that we improve our school system so that we Americans can once again have the esteem and believing that if it can be done well, we can do it better through training.
Colombia's vice president said yesterday that he planned to give you a detailed response to questions you raised about Colombia's labor laws. Were you satisfied with his responses, and do you see Congress approving the Colombia free trade deal?
I met with him late last night, and his response to our request of May of last year has not yet been studied by staff.
House Ways and Means Committee Chairman Charles Rangel, a New York Democrat, taking questions this month at the National Press Club in Washington. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Will Congress pass a minimum wage bill this year, and what is the likelihood that the president would sign it?
Well, the House passed a minimum wage bill without any tax cuts, and the Senate then sent the bill, then could not send the bill to us because constitutionally it would have to emanate from the House. In order to assist in establishing some type of preparation for a conference, the leadership of the House agreed, to put a $1.3 billion bill together designed really to protect small employers and job opportunity and tax prevention, and we paid for it. When we sent that over to the Senate, they attached an $8.3 billion tax cut, much of it not going to small businesses. Recently, we put the whole package in the supplemental package, and I'm working with the committee to see what we are willing to accept, since they have a $12 billion tax cut, which we think that they put it in there just to get our attention, and we have a 1.3. We're anxious to go to conference because we want very badly the minimum wage bill.
Will there be any additional action in Congress to protect workers' pensions from underfunding, plan freezes, and terminations now that the Pension Protection Act has been enacted?
I can't answer that, but we have yet to establish our full agenda. This afternoon I'll be meeting with Chairman Baucus, and before the week is out, I'll be talking with Jim McQuarrie to see whether we can get a compatible agenda, not only on our committee, but working with Grassley and Baucus.
More than 40 million Americans are without health care insurance. Will you use your position as chair of the Ways and Means Committee to try to press for universal coverage, and do you favor a single-payer plan?
Yes to the last two questions, but we think that's too big a task for us to handle. But the 48 million people without coverage, we have now found new friends coming to the table and wanting to see whether we can work out something. Our manufacturers have claimed that they are paying more for health care than they are for steel and other necessary expenses. And we're trying to convince them that they're competing with companies that come from countries where education and health care is not considered a subsidy, and that unless they can come and try to find some way that they can share on this side of the ocean, then they'll be at a disadvantage. So we're not confident, but we are optimistic that we can do something in this Congress to deal with the 48 million.
Health and Human Services Secretary Mike Leavitt said this morning on C-SPAN's Washington Journal that House and Senate bills to authorize the government to negotiate lower Medicare drug prices with pharmaceutical companies would be unnecessary because both the Congressional Budget Office under the Republican Congress and the present Democratic Congress has said that there would be no real cost savings from those sorts of negotiations. Is Mr. Leavitt right, or is such legislation necessary?
The legislation that we have supported authorizes the secretary to negotiate. I don't see why people be so upset just in going near this relationship between Medicare and the pharmaceuticals. If indeed he has the authority and sorts not to use it, the only thing that he has to worry about is oversight. And they haven't been used to this in a long time. But we don't say there's a mandate. We say the secretary is authorized. And they've had more press conferences than we have on this, with the exception of Gonzalez and those other things.
Okay, actually, we have a lot of very serious questions here about Iraq and about what happened yesterday at Virginia Tech. And let me just ask a question about that. In light of the tragedy at Virginia Tech, how do you feel about the nation's current gun control laws? Should they be more strict, and should the Second Amendment be repealed?
No, on the last. I don't think so. If you're hunting and accurate enough not to shoot people in the face, I don't really think that your gun rights should be taken away from you. It seemed to me that someone with an automatic weapon committing the type of atrocity and the painfulness, that should be enough to try to put some control over automatic pistols. I'm working with Mayor Bloomberg, and he's established about 30 or 40 mayors, and I'm organizing, me and Peter King, the congressional delegation, to say that Congress has to do something. I know that the National Rifle Club is very powerful, but I really believe that when someone asked a member how many people in his district supported gun control, he said 85%. I said, why do you always vote against it? He said the 15% are organized. I think we have to be organized. It just doesn't make any sense to have these type of weapons out there that has nothing to do with hunting.
Do you think the tragedy that happened yesterday could change the political debate on this issue at all?
I asked that question with a group of Democrats today, and the people that I expected to say no said no. It's a regional thing, it's a cultural thing, and it's a sad thing, but there's some type of cult. Don't touch, don't take the gun from my dead cold hands, and I don't understand it, but obviously there is a political differences of opinion on that.
Okay, now on Iraq. Now that the Shia ministers of the Iraqi government have resigned because Iraqi President Alawi has refused to set a date for the withdrawal of foreign troops, do you think that the Bush administration would look more favorably at the benchmarks in the military funding bills in the Senate and the House?
Okay, here goes the speech. You asked for it. I have no idea what's on my president's mind as it relates to our involvement in the Middle East. Even if you remember long enough that not one reason that he gave for us sending our troops into harm's way exists today. And this whole idea that American soldiers, through a surge, is going to be able to resolve the problems that these people have had in this area for centuries is totally unbelievable. Here we come from a great republic that's trying to work out its race problems, acting as though we have the capacity to work out these cultural problems. And really what gets me are just two basic things. One, if the enemy was to say that she wanted to surrender tomorrow, just whom would we take the surrender papers to? Where will the victory be? And I wish somebody would tell me, what is the role of our so-called friends in that area that understand these people and supposed to be our friends? The Egyptians, which we give billions of dollars every year to be nice to Israel, have not come to do anything to assist us in resolving this area, to their satisfaction, certainly not ours. I don't know how many Americans go to sleep at night wondering whether the Shiites or the Sunnis are going to win. When it comes to the Saudis, 15 or 16 of those who knocked down our World Trade Building came from Saudi Arabia. And yet, they spend more time at Crawford Ranch than any Democrats I know. But I can't think of one thing that they've offered to contribute. And the King of Jordan, he's on TV more than me, and you would think that he would say, look, we made a mistake. Let us all come together and see whether we can help resolve it. And so I end up saying, if the president is only getting his information from the vice president, we got a problem here, a very serious problem. And I don't see how our troops can resolve this issue.
Charles Rangel, the Democratic chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, in a recent question and answer session at the National Press Club in Washington. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Do you think the invasion of Iraq has made another 9/11 more or less likely?
Oh, come on. Next question. The connection between, I mean, if Osama bin Laden is in Afghanistan and we wanted to knock off some Saddam Hussein years before 9/11, there's no connection, absolutely none. And how in the heck, and the president just said it recently, if we don't kill them over there, they got to come kill us over here. Why should we not have a mandatory program of national service to have enough people here looking out for the terrorists than sending people in harm's way in Iraq? I don't think anyone takes that type of talk seriously. I hope not.
How different would the war have turned out if we did have a draft rather than an all-volunteer military?
There would not have been a war. If people thought for 1 minute that knocking off Saddam Hussein meant putting their children in harm's way, or if there were enough people in the Congress who understood it, or even now, if they have attended as many funerals as some of us have, and knowing that a draft would be imminent, it wouldn't happen.
With the Army and the Marine Corps admittedly stretched thin, do you think your bill to reinstitute the draft will have new life?
No, the troops will be brought back home.
Pardon me?
The troops will be brought back home. Where can you get the troops? These guys are exhausted. They're our National Guard. They are reservists. They are volunteers. They've gone over 3, 4, 5 times. Every one of them is thinking on a new tour. Is it my turn now? Have I been lucky? Am I going to get shot? And so there's going to reach a point that you will not be able to continue to send them there. And then they'll talk, as they do now, about the draft. And then the president will know that he has to bring the troops home.
Might it become necessary, given how overly taxed our military has become, for us to do a draft?
Doing a draft means getting members to vote for it, and that's not going to happen. We're not going to get any members to vote for sending their sons and daughters on a mission of surge in the Middle East. You think so?
I'm not supposed to have opinions. I'm supposed to read questions from a card.
Sound like Republican there.
That's not what my readers say.
Joke.
Some of the emails.
Joke. Okay.
Okay, here's a good one. You have said that the Bush administration's rationale for invading Iraq was the biggest fraud ever committed on the people of this country. How do you defend this strong statement?
Well, we've lost 3,500 Americans. 30,000 seriously wounded, hundreds of thousands of people have died. And the reason we lost them is because the president made a decision to make an appeal to the Congress for the authority to go to war. And the reasons that he said was that there was weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein was directly connected with 9/11, that he also was connected with Al-Qaeda. And so none of those things has proven to be true. Now, we could say that the president wasn't intelligent enough to understand the intelligence reports. Or we could say that, give the guy a break, he's never left Texas except to visit Mexico, so how should he know? Or we should say that everybody who was around him at the time indicating that she'd follow Osama bin Laden, that he insisted that he wanted to get Saddam Hussein. Now, maybe in these nice prestigious halls I should find a word that's more sophisticated, but in Harlem, it's fraud.
If it is the biggest fraud ever committed on the people of this country, why have you not joined Elizabeth Holtzman and others in calling for President Bush and President and Vice President Cheney's impeachment?
Dick Cheney.
Vice President Cheney and the President of the United States.
Not enough votes.
Is that the only reason, do you think, in principle it's called for?
Well, since, as a former prosecutor, I would know that an impeachment is something like a grand jury. You're not saying anyone's guilty of anything, that you're searching for the truth. But it is a war, whether we like it or not. And as an American and as a patriot, I really don't believe in times of war that you should impeach both the president and vice president. Then we had Rumsfeld that was there, and it just didn't look like a good idea at the time. But keep pushing, though.
How about one or the other?
I said, this, I think, is not the time. That was said when we were in a minority. I think we got a better strategy.
The Congressional Black Caucus has listed you as a hypocrite, so says this questioner, because while Representatives Waters, Lee, and John Lewis are both opposed to the war and to the funding, you would vote to fund it. How would you respond?
Well, we did not have enough votes to get everything cut off because we thought that most Americans believed, which is not so, that by cutting off the funds for the war completely, that we could not provide for the funds to bring the troops back home. So for whatever reason, we didn't have the votes there. And I wanted to make certain that I fulfilled the mandate of the American people who were concerned about the war. The only way we could effectively do that is to get 218 votes and to put a timetable. I don't think the timetable is nearly as important as telling the president that our constituents want us out of there.
Do you think the Bush administration is trying to build democracy in the Middle East, or is there another agenda at play? What might that be?
I wish I could find out why the president is so adamant and aggressively pursuing this war in the Middle East. And if he's talking about democracies, you know, we spend a lot of time with Red China and Vietnam. There are disputes all over the world that we can invest our time in and have a better idea and assurances that it would be successful than in the Middle East. As I pointed out, the problems of the Middle East are centuries old, and I cannot see why he would just pick this one place to decide to cast his bucket for democracy in the Middle East. Is a very difficult task.
Okay, a couple political questions here.
You're kidding.
Oh, we got to it eventually. your PAC reported some impressive fundraising numbers for the first quarter. Does that tell you that the campaign finance system is working or is broken?
It means that, and I don't know why, but I've acquired a whole lot of new friends since January. You know, I don't know why that would be. But a reporter asked me that, and the bottom question was, and how much, what do you use it for? And I told them 75,000 went to the freshmen, new members, and 400,000 went to the DCCC, and that in my 38 years, I have not asked anybody ever for a contribution. So it has to be love.
Okay, our last question, a political question. If Rudy Giuliani gets the Republican presidential nomination and Hillary Clinton gets the Democratic presidential nomination, won't New York's electoral votes, unlike the last five times, be up for grabs?
Well, if Giuliani gets the Republican nomination with Kerik as his partner, I don't think we'll have any problems.
I don't think he's going to be the running mate.
Well, I didn't think Giuliani would be the candidate, but you can't have Giuliani without Kerik. Take my word for it.
You would know.
New York Democratic Congressman Charles Rangel making a reference there to former New York City Police Commissioner Bernard Kerik, a friend of Republican presidential hopeful and former New York City Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. You may remember that Bernard Kerik withdrew his nomination to be Homeland Security Secretary in 2004 after admitting to hiring an illegal immigrant as a nanny. His problems didn't stop there. He's currently the target of a federal investigation into tax evasion and illegal wiretapping. He's probably not Rudolph Giuliani's first choice for a running mate. Congressman Rangel, who chairs the powerful House Ways and Means Committee, spoke April 17th at the National Press Club in Washington. If you missed part of today's speech from Charles Rangel, or if you would just like to hear it again, you can find it at our website. That's wordforword.org. In addition to hearing this week's show, you may also subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs, including recent speakers such as former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich, Democratic Senator John Kerry, and Bob Woodruff of ABC News. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Pencava.
Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph, and the technical director is Kyle Sisko.
American Public Media.